Morning. If it pleases the court, I'm James Wisman, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County, appearing on behalf of the State of Washington. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor, if I may. There are two issues linked to this same basic claim here. One is whether the defendant's lawyer at trial was ineffective for failing to present evidence of moral decency through reputation, and secondly, whether or not there's a due process right to counsel free of mental illness. And we've covered both of those in our briefing, and I'd like to just start, if I may, by changing the order in which I'm going to address these things as follows. I think probably the simplest way to get to the core of why the trial court's ruling was erroneous would be to simply recognize that that there isn't a sufficient showing of prejudice under these circumstances, because essentially Mr. Witchley did an extremely good job of presenting the functional equivalent of reputation evidence through the testimony of witnesses like Ruth Acosta and all of the witnesses that he called, essentially creating in a jury's mind the impression that this was a person who was trustworthy in his community, amongst his friends, in this school community, and they trusted him with their children on a personal level and on a professional level. And he did this very skillfully throughout the entire trial. So the fact that he was able to present that evidence without drawing the direct fire that would have been drawn had he presented witnesses through reputation evidence, I think shows that presenting these witnesses by the reputation witnesses wouldn't have made a difference in this trial. And the
well, that would make a difference as to the Strickland ruling.
Correct.
What do you understand to be the 14th Amendment ruling? Presumably, were such a right to exist, it would only activate when Strickland was otherwise satisfied, which would seem to indicate that the right discussed by Judge Heller is akin to a right, the violation of which gives rise to a remedy even in the absence of prejudice, since Strickland discusses prejudice.
You know, that I would just have to speculate, because there is absolutely no case law on that point. He didn't cite any, counsel hasn't cited any in his appeal. And
analyze it, would we analyze it in any way other than it would of necessity be structural error? A lawyer who has mental illness is the same as no lawyer at all. So it's a structural error, just as if the gentleman had sat there without anybody sitting next to him.
I presume that's the thinking behind it, although that wasn't articulated so in that fashion, nor is there any case law that says it. But I don't know how you would otherwise analyze it, except if you were to try and duplicate or somehow modify the Strickland type approach. So I think that is probably the logical consequence of adopting a rule like that. And I'll just note that at its outset, there are all sorts of problems to begin with. What is mental illness, or what constitutes mental illness? I have no idea. It's such a broad spectrum of things that could be swept into it. And I think that's part of the reason that courts have refused to go down that road, is because it's undefinable even at the outset. But even if you I think it's an inappropriate rule, because it is divorced from what actually took place in the trial.
Isn't there another problem with that? I mean, we have a diagnostic manual that professionals who diagnose mental illness use, and cognitive impairment is not always an element of the diagnosis. You can be completely competent in sense of cognitive ability and have a personality disorder.
Correct. Exactly, and that's what I mean by the layperson's term mental illness encompasses so much that I have no idea.
Doesn't even the professionals?
Yes. Yes, and I.
Ted Bundy's trial judge, in the proceeding in which he sentenced him to death for the death of the 12-year-old girl, praised his advocacy skills. Was Bundy entitled to a new trial because he represented him pro se at a time when he had suffered from mental illness?
Right, and I think that's exactly the problem. I think that's why the Strickland analysis is the appropriate analysis, because it focuses on what actually happened in the trial. And that's why, in this case, although I think that there are a lot of good reasons for saying that counsel wasn't deficient and that this type of evidence should not have been admitted in trial at all, I think if you focus on what Mr. Witchley actually did in this trial, you show that what his therapist or psychiatrist, I forget which, said is true, and that is Steve is able to work very productively in focused areas, though he has difficulty with managing the various demands of a full-time legal practice. And that's what we saw in this case. I mean, I don't mean to minimize the struggles that he faced, and he clearly had difficulties, but he rallied, and he did, frankly, what I consider to be a better-than-average job in this case. I mean, I'm sure you all have looked at a lot of these transcripts, and I have, and I think that Mr. Witchley did, in spite of his difficulties, did a better job than many lawyers I see in this type of case. So, and that's where the focus ought to be. That's why it's an objective standard that we look at. That's why you ask whether the lawyer's performance was objectively reasonable. And I think that by those measures, it was. Turning just quickly to the evidentiary question, I think that this court's decision in Jackson is the better rule. I know that there's some controversy.
Does it matter? Is there any reason in deciding this case why we would make a decision akin to the decision that we would make if there had been evidence offered and it had been excluded and there was an appeal from that ruling?
Now, it doesn't matter. You don't need to decide that to resolve the case. Those are alternative arguments. So, as I say, I think the clearest thing is to say it didn't make a difference in this case on the prejudice prong, but even going back to the deficiency prong, it was a debatable point of evidence, and reasonable attorneys could have taken the approach that he took instead of relying on evidence.
May it please the court. My name is George Paul Trejo, Jr., on behalf of the respondent, Oscar Lopez. In dealing with the issue that the court has questioned about, I think it's significant to examine what all Mr. Witchley was suffering from. He was pending disbarment, a disbarment that took place 2 months after this trial was completed.
What if he just had a diagnosis that he had brain cancer and he had 12 months to live? And other than during the time when he was preparing for trial and was in trial, he was consumed by concerns for his own mortality. And at the end of the case, even though he tried the case as well as most lawyers in King County would try the case, he was convinced that he would have done a better job if he hadn't been so consumed with this knowledge that he was going to die in a couple of months. Does that violate the 14th Amendment, him representing the gentleman in that case?
I think it could. It could, Your Honor. But I think what we have here that significantly weighs on that issue is the fact that the trial court was able to personally observe Mr. Witchley and had to sanction him on a number of times for his failure to be attentive to the case by arriving late, by not showing up, 80 minutes late.
Well, you seem now to be saying, so do we apply the Strickland standard to this 14th Amendment, right?
We don't have to. No, we don't have to at all, Your Honor. But
well, then I don't follow then why you're talking about things he did wrong. If he suffered, your position is if he suffered from mental illness, it's structural error. There's a new trial.
Yes.
No matter how well he did it. No matter how well he did the trial.
Well,
he does an exemplary job. No one could do it better.
But we have
conquering this fear he has of his impending death from brain cancer.
But we don't have that in this case.
No, but we would have it in the next case.
We very well might.
And
but
so that's what we do here.
Okay.
So here we have a lawyer, my hypothetical lawyer, who tries the case better than anyone else in King County could try this case, conquering his fear of his impending death from brain cancer. And the 14th Amendment requires that case be tried again. Is that, that's where we go with this, right?
Couple that with Mr. Witcherly's subjective beliefs that it was even difficult for him to get out of bed, that he shouldn't have taken this case to begin with, that he wasn't in a state of mind to do the trial. Now, if the person with the brain cancer has that same beliefs going on in his mind, that I shouldn't be here.
So he has the belief, and it doesn't matter whether the belief actually manifested itself in any way and how the case was tried. It's just simply the fact that he has the belief.
Not merely that, because as a trial lawyer, we need to have the appropriate state of mind to vigorously advocate on the part of our client. Now, we can read the transcripts.
Well, other than under the Sixth Amendment, as a trial lawyer, what the Constitution requires is a level of advocacy that does not fall below an objective standard of reasonableness.
Correct.
So I don't know if we're describing the same thing. It sounds to me like you're describing something a little bit better.
Okay.
A lawyer who's more invested, who isn't just the constitutional minimum. But obviously there has to be a constitutional minimum.
That's correct,
right? John. And if you're above the constitutional minimum, it's not a problem. And if you're below, it is, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. In that regard, Your Honor, are we going to hold that an attorney, and I won't go through all the list of things that Mr. Witcherly was suffering from, are we going to say that the things that Mr. Witcherly was suffering from is acceptable?
Well, why wouldn't we ask a different question? Why wouldn't we ask what in his performance denied this defendant a fair trial and not care about why that performance was deficient? I mean, isn't that really what we're concerned about? What happened in the courtroom? Did the defendant get what he was supposed to get, a fair trial?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that's where, at least in my opinion, the trial court is in the best position to make that determination.
Well, but the trial court, even though he commented on tardiness, said for the most part he thought Mr. Witcherly did a very good job.
Well, I would beg to differ with that, Your Honor. I don't think he said that he did a very good job. And then it goes over to the evidentiary issue. He said he should have investigated that. He should have researched that instead of just turning a blind eye to it.
Well, he said he did a good job. He's a very able trial attorney and a competent attorney for the most part, except for the evidentiary issues.
Yeah, for the most part.
Well, it was except for the evidentiary issues. So the ruling was based on the evidentiary issues.
On the evidentiary issue.
But he acknowledges he did a good job. He criticizes him for those the two evidentiary issues.
But he also conducted the analysis about Mr. Witcherly's personal problems that he was suffering from.
And our question is, how do we deal with the rule that you've advocated, which would essentially entitle a defendant to a new trial, no matter what the quality of the trial he received was, whether it was a perfect trial, a very fair trial, or an unfair trial?
Well, I think the Supreme Court in Brett touched upon that when it found in that case involving the murder charge, found that an attorney facing disbarment, that in and of itself was not sufficient to meet the standard required of a reasonably prudent defense attorney. So if we can find that the disbarment pendency is sufficient, but why not the disbarment plus all of these other factors?
Haven't courts held that someone who isn't even licensed as a lawyer, showing that isn't sufficient to satisfy a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, that you need to show something beyond that? We've looked and not found a single case where the court didn't look to what happened in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what your rule seems to, the proposed rule seems to abandon.
Well, I don't think the position that the respondent is taking abandons that because of Judge Heller's ruling. I believe Judge Heller's ruling supports our position, where he even found that it's not a straight Strickland analysis, but invokes the due process analysis in determining that a new trial was warranted.
Yeah. Is there any reported decision after 1940 that links the right to counsel in a criminal case to the due process clause rather than to the Sixth Amendment?
I'm not aware of one, Your Honor. I would have cited it.
I don't remember what the Scarborough Boys case was based on, so that's why I picked my limiting thing. Okay, so there's nothing you're aware of. So we're sort of uncharted territory.
Right. No, and I would agree, and I would think that counsel agrees that in many respects what's presented to the court in the Lopez matter is a case of first impression, given all of the anomalies that exist in this matter. If the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, I thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wisman, you've got 3 minutes.
Your Honor, I don't have much to add unless the court has any questions.
Maybe you can answer the question I just asked, counsel. I don't remember what in Powell versus Alabama what constitutional provision they were talking about. So setting aside 1930s death penalty cases from the Deep South, is there any case that you're aware of that's a reported decision that ties the right to counsel in a criminal case to the 14th Amendment as opposed to the 6th Amendment?
No, and in fact, I cited several cases in my briefing. I don't remember if it was in the opening brief or in the reply, that where courts have expressly rejected that approach and said, we don't do that. We analyze this under the 6th Amendment. So there's just no authority for it. I'm not sure if there's a Washington case that expressly rejects that approach, but it's certainly inconsistent with the long line of authority in Washington. I was just going to note that the Brett case is different because, of course, in Brett, the defense lawyer abjectly failed to present a defense. And so it was in that context that the court was looking to the Bar Association matters, et cetera. But again, you're looking at what happened at the trial, not whether or not he had family difficulties, was going through a divorce, you know, had a death in the family, was facing cancer treatment, et cetera. The focus is, in spite of those things, how did the person perform?
And it's my understanding that under a Strickland analysis, you think the most straightforward approach is prejudice because of the arguable dispute related to Jackson in the Division II case.
Yeah, I frankly don't think that is much of a problem. But still, I think the most direct way to decide it is to say he got the same evidence in a different way, and frankly, I think better evidence. Reputation evidence is odd. You know, I think
it's very limited.
It's odd and it's limited, I think, to lay people. They kind of tilt their head sideways when they hear it. And it also invites then the retort from us, like, what is it? How is anybody going to have a reputation in the community for this? And you can mock it, really, in a way that you can't as easily mock the strategy that Mr. Witchley employed, which is to inculcate the jury in this idea that this guy's trustworthy. So I think he got what he needed.
In assessing prejudice under the Strickland standards, or over the Sixth Amendment, the law is replete with cases that say that prejudice cannot be shown by the hope that there would be a lawless decision maker.
Correct.
In other words, we have to assume that the jury would follow its instructions, not that they would nullify. Does that apply to a trial judge?
Well, I think
does Strickland preclude a trial judge from being a lawless decision maker and not following controlling precedent?
I think in a way it does, because a trial judge can't say the result would have been different if I had allowed this inadmissible evidence.
But this judge did.
He did say that. That's right. But what I'm saying is that's not a reason to overturn a conviction. He's not entitled to the inadmissible evidence. But now we're getting back into more of a deficient performance question.
Okay. Thank you.
We ask the court to reverse.
Next up, thank you both. Next up, State.